Good afternoon, members. The Select Committee on Health Innovation will now come to order. Judeline, please call the roll.
Chair Tuck.
Here.
Representatives Alvarez.
Here.
Representative Andrade is excused. Barrero.
Here.
Casello.
Here.
Chamberlain.
Here.
Gonzalez Pittman.
Present.
Lopez J.
Here.
Lopez V.
Here.
Rayner.
Present.
Rizzo.
Here.
Silvers.
Here.
Steele.
Here.
Tremont.
Here.
And Williams.
Here.
A quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you, members. By your presence, we have a quorum. Just as a reminder, please silence all your cell phones, computers, beepers, electronic devices, whatever you have. And members of the audience, just as a housekeeping matter, we are not hearing bills today, so we will not be accepting public testimony, but we do have two presentations for you to listen to and enjoy today. The first presentation we have is HB 391 from the 2023 legislative session. Before we start, I'll ask you to please hold your questions until the end of the presentation. And with us from ACA is Austin Knoll, the Deputy Secretary for Medicaid Policy, Quality and Operations, and Kim Smoke, the Deputy Secretary for Healthcare Policy and Oversight. Mr. Knoll, Ms. Smoke, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, or good afternoon, Chair Tuck and representatives on the House Select Committee on Health Innovation. As the Chair introduced, I am Austin Knoll, and I have the pleasure of serving as one of the Deputy Secretaries for the Agency for Healthcare Administration. With me today is my counterpart, Kim Smoke, who's also a Deputy Secretary, and both of us will be presenting on House Bill 391, Home Health Aides for Medically Fragile Children. The House Bill 391, I'd like to thank Representative Tremont for introducing this piece of legislation, and it directs the agency on six parts. First, though, the program was created to decrease the hospitalization of medically fragile children, reduce state expenditures, and provide an opportunity for a family caregiver to receive training and employment. As we see on the slide, this is accomplished through six initiatives. First, it is to allow for a family caregiver to serve the children and their family at an hourly rate of $25 per hour after completing a training program at which the agency will be conducting an annual assessment and reporting that out to the legislature with the first report due January 2025. The legislature granted the agency 4 FTE to help with this initiative. So diving into each of those parts in a little bit more detail. House Bill 391 directs the agency to allow for this new type of home health agency worker. Specifically, to be this worker, they must first be employed by a licensed home health agency. They have to be 18 years of older and be a family caregiver of an eligible relative. That would be someone that is in the Medicaid program. They have to have a demonstration of minimum competencies as well as graduate from an approved training program, as well as successfully pass the required background screening. As far as the children that they can serve, the patient must be 21 years of age or younger and have an underlying physical, mental, or cognitive impairment that prevents the child from safely living independently and is eligible to receive skilled care or respite care under the Medicaid program. The patient also must be related to the family caregiver. With this program, HB 391 directed the agency to establish a new Medicaid fee schedule for the individuals in this program. The way this will be structured is that the payments will be made to the licensed home health agency, and reimbursement must be at $25 an hour. However, reimbursement will be capped at no more than 8 hours per day to make sure we're not overburdening the family. As to the training program, I'm going to turn that over to Kim Smoke to discuss that.
Thank you. Thanks for allowing me to be here this afternoon. And we are we're all aware there's been an ongoing challenge in the state for our home health agencies providing sufficient qualified caregivers to meet the needs of children. Just to give you a little bit of data, there are currently 2,423 licensed home health agencies in Florida, and 758 of those home health agencies provide skilled services to children in the state. Outlined on this slide, you'll see that the agency is required to consult with Department of Health Board of Nursing for adoption of rules regarding the training program required in this bill. And the training program must consist of the 85 hours. That's a lot of hours of training that include 40 hours of theoretical instructions in nursing. So that would be the person-centered care, infection control, safe and emergency procedures. So these are just a couple of examples. 20 hours would be required of skills training on basic nursing skills, such as wound treatment, hygiene, grooming, toileting, skin care, pressure ulcer or sore prevention, as well as measuring vitals and safe lifting of the children. Additionally, 16 hours of clinical training under that direct supervision of a registered nurse. So that's a registered nurse. 6 hours of medication training, medication administration, 2 hours of CPR, and 1 hour of HIV/AIDS makes up that total of 85 hours. Additionally, these caregivers would be required to have 12 hours of in-service as part of the employment during that 12-month period of time, so a lot of training required. We decided at the agency to proceed with rulemaking for consistency, especially with our ongoing collaboration with Department of Health with past rules and current rules. The language states in the agency in collaboration may approve the training programs developed by home health agencies. So in an effort to provide parameters, we felt that laying these requirements out in rule would benefit the industry. The annual assessment, so the annual assessment outlined here is key element number 4, which requires required by the agency to conduct an annual assessment. And the annual assessment must capture 3 requirements: caregiver satisfaction with the program, identifying additional support that may be needed by the home health aide for medically fragile children, and lastly, assess the rate and extent of hospitalization of children in home health services who are attended by a home health aide for medically fragile children compared to those in home helps without a home health aide for medically fragile children. And the time frame, I'll go over the time frame, I think it's on our next slide. For the reporting requirements. So the last part of the requirement, as you see here, is outlined at key element 5 for the report of the annual assessment. Starting January the 1st of 2025, we'll be required to provide a report to the governor, the president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House with the findings of our annual report. So for the first year of our report, we anticipate having around maybe 6 to 7 months of data once everything gets into place and the annual assessment is sent out to gather that data. I think this is you.
So what we laid out is what is contained in the bill and what are we required to do. Next, we're going to talk about the status of where we are to date on the different steps towards implementation. First, one of the things that we have to do is amend or update our systems to allow for the billing of these home health aides for the medically fragile children. So we're working with our vendors to ensure those updates are being made and are ready to go live once rulemaking related to the licensure, as my counterpart mentioned, is complete. We also have to amend our Medicaid state plan. The state plan is what gives us the authority to draw down our federal funds to incorporate the changes from the home health aides for these children. We've drafted an amendment to this, and we plan to incorporate it as part of the licensure rulemaking by reference. It'll be finalized to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or federal CMS, once the licensure rulemaking is complete. As far as the fee schedule with the $25 an hour, we have been drafting the updates needed to that fee schedule to allow the home health agencies to be reimbursed for these services provided by home health aides. The updated fee schedule following our normal process can be promulgated or posted once the rulemaking has concluded. And then I'll turn it over to Kim for her section.
Thank you. So additionally, for healthcare policy and oversight implementation, This slide, along with the next slide I'll go over, outlines the steps for implementation or the status of the implementation regarding the bill. So the training program, as I mentioned early in the presentation, the bill required us to work in coordination with Department of Health, Board of Nursing to approve the training program. We've already developed draft language that has already been shared with Department of Health, Board of Nursing. We'll be routing draft language internally so we can quickly proceed to publish the review of the language, publish the rule, and review of the training for personnel hired as aides for medically fragile children will be incorporated into our home health survey process that we do when we conduct surveys. As you can see here, the second part, consultation with Department of Health, Board of Nursing. We do have a meeting scheduled actually with Department of Health next week on the 15th of December to get this to move forward. And again, we've already drafted the language. It's already been sent to Department of Health. We are proceeding internally with review and posting that the rule requirements. The hiring of the 4 additional FTEs, thank you for incorporating that into this bill. We are still in the process of hiring for those positions. These positions were allocated, as you know, related to this bill. We'll be involved in reviewing the home health agency programs. All those 4 positions have been advertised, positions have been closed, and staff are in the process of reviewing applications to hire staff and to set up interviews. But we are not pausing the rollout of this program while we're getting those positions in place. We're doing it with already existing resources. Additionally, as we mentioned here, the development of our annual assessment, although the status says pending final rule adoption, we are doing that at the same time. So simultaneously, we are moving forward with developing the annual assessment because, as I mentioned earlier, there are 3 key components. Those are already outlined for us, so we're developing that annual assessment now. We'll be conducting the annual assessment as soon as we get that rule in place, which we hope to have that in place very quickly as we are routing our rule package now, and then submitting the annual assessment, submitting findings from the annual assessment that will be required January the 1st of 2025. And this last slide just kind of shows our timeline and a brief overview of our steps for full implementation of this bill. And it kind of goes through what Deputy Secretary Austin Nolan and I talked about earlier, credentialing, getting our licensure rule in place, which I talked about where we are with that, amending the state plan, updating the Medicaid systems that we currently have, and then finalizing that fee schedule as well. So that goes through our presentation for House Bill 391. Thank y'all for having us today.
Ms. Smoke, Mr. Knoll, thank y'all so much for being here. Members, what questions do you have? Ranking Member Costello, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a kebble. I think you might have mentioned, I might have missed it on the slide. When are you projecting that ACCA will have completed the rulemaking process and adopt the final rule?
You're recognized.
Thank you. We're on a very aggressive timeline. Obviously, we can't dictate exactly, but our goal is to publish the rule next week, and then to it will show up in the FAR in early January, and then have a workshop from there, and then for us to move very quickly. Since we know this is something that's very positive, that the industry has really been working with us on. I myself have gotten several phone calls from family members. They're very excited about it. I've walked through with them how to sign up for alerts to get notified. We're hoping that this process will move very quickly through the rulemaking.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you conducted any analysis on how many family caregivers may be eligible and interested in participating in this program?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Not at this time, we have not. Our goal has been really focused on implementation, and I'm not sure if Deputy Secretary Knoll has any comments on that.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative. And when we conducted our bill analysis, we looked at how many children would be potentially eligible, and that number was just north of 5,000 recipients at that time. And so depending on the different take-up, whether or not families elect to use this will be variable from that point. But At the time the bill was passed, it was about 5,000 recipients.
Thank you. That's all, ma'am.
Representative Williams, recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide two, you spoke about establishing an hourly rate of $25. How did you come up with the $25?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. The $25 was part of the legislation that was passed.
Follow up.
If these kids was in a facility, what would be the rate that they will be paying the facilities?
You're recognized.
Thank you for that question. I don't have that exact rate in front of me right now. We can get that back to you, though.
Follow up.
One more. As you spoke about the training that you're offering, how is that different from what we already have in place?
Some is consistent with what we do have in place. Some is consistent from what we do have in place, and there's some additional requirements added. As I mentioned, it's 85 hours. Currently for home health agencies, on the federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid service requirements are 75 hours for our home health aides, and so this does go beyond that.
Follow up? Sounds good. Representative Gonzalez-Pittman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the presentation. What happens to the children after they're 21?
Oh.
You reckon?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative, for the question. It largely depends on that individual child's situation as far as do they become Medicaid eligible on their own? Do they then move into potentially one of the other waiver programs? Each situation could be different depending on the individual's situation at that time.
Follow up? All good? Representative Tremont, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a ton of questions. Great presentation. I appreciate the efforts and the milestones that we've reached thus far. But I still do have a number of questions to throw at you. I looked at the accomplishments that we had thus far. Draft rule created, meeting scheduled for December, positions advertised. I'm curious as to when those things were put in the success mark.
You recognize
you. I mean, when we did each one of those steps.
Yes, because I'm remembering, it wasn't but several weeks ago where it looked like we have no movement on this, and now we've requested a meeting here, and now I'm seeing some activity. So I want to know that it's not because we're requesting responses here, mm-hmm. but rather there's activity because there really is a genuine sense of urgency to get this implemented. So that's what I'm asking right now.
Sure. Yes, sir. We've actually have been working on this since the bill was filed, and after it was signed by the governor, we have been working on this. It took us a while to kind of, within our existing resources to come up with a rule language, but we've worked on that and have a good product. We had to schedule it with Department of Health, and they, like us, are very busy, so that's why it took us a while to get something scheduled with them, but we had reached out to them earlier before we knew we were having this presentation. For FTE positions, they have been advertised, and so, like I said, advertised, closed, and we are in the process of hiring those, but we have not slowed down or stopped our process because of not having those positions in place.
Follow up?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Thank you for your response, and I know of your passion for this as well, and I'm grateful for that. An additional question, probably two more, Madam Chair, if you can indulge me, in regarding the fee schedule and the payment, the payment options for the family. I understand that 25 is going to the home health agency itself. I want to make sure that there are language in the rules as they're created to make sure that the parents, the ones who are the ones taking care of their child, are being paid appropriately. I don't want skimping, and I don't want to see any pocketing from some of these agencies. So is there a discussion to make sure that is mandated in the rules that the dollars are going where they're supposed to go to bring relief to the families?
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. I will take that back to our policy team to work with them on the rule language and be sure, any time we're in rural development on that front, we can take public comment, which this counts as, and we can discuss it and make sure that we promulgate the rule with the intention that is behind the statute.
And who is the point person on this? And you, if you don't have to tell me now, you can tell me afterwards, but I'd like to someone that I can be,
that would be me, sir,
in conversation with.
That would be me.
One final, but I can come back if you'd like.
No, go for it.
When is the expected time for implementation? And I ask this because I can recall last time that we were here having a discussion, there was a bill that passed 2 years ago. I don't want to see that. So is there a goal in mind where we're at? And I'm quite sure, I'm familiar with how government works, we can set a goal and it likely won't be there, but I don't want to be here 2 years. I don't want to be here a year from now, next session, talking about it. So where are you at in setting the mark on implementation?
You're recognized.
So I'll go and then ask Deputy Secretary Smoke if she wants to add anything to it. She introduced it's a multi-step process with this bill, and the first is setting up the licensure and the rule requirements with that. And once that's in place, then we can update the system and move forward. The rulemaking, as she just indicated earlier, is scheduled to notice in January. And depending on public comments and the feedback we get from the community, that may or may not change any anticipated time frame. However, we want to make sure we get this right. I mean, these are fragile children. We want to make sure anything we set in the rule is intended to do exactly what we want it to do. So although there might not be a finite time certain as to when that is done because of the variability in the rule process.
I can just add up.
I can't let you off the hook. That was a strategy on how to get to the end. But, you know, if I'm leading something and I'm trying to get someplace, I got to know where my end goal is. You know, and I get things can come up, but, you know, and yes, it has to be done right, but there has to be done well and swiftly as well. So I want to see a goal. I want to know where we're going, because if we don't put a goal out, then we can just answer the same way every time we come back.
Sure. So to piggyback a little bit on Deputy Secretary Noel's comments, we will continue to aggressively discuss this internally between my division and Deputy Secretary Noel's division, as we are working closely together on this. And one kind of piggybacks on the other. We understand that we have been as aggressive. Could we speed it up? Absolutely. And that's what a discussion I had with my team. So if we're routing the rule internally, we should be able to get it to OFAR later this week, publish the development by December the 13th, workshop in January, early January, right after break, which would be like January the 4th. Then we could move forward pretty quickly in getting any rule comments then. And so if you could give us till about maybe mid-January to get our rule in place, and then we could maybe follow back up with a more aggressive time frame for the rest of the implementation. But hopefully that answers a little bit of your questions of our, you know, our aggressiveness in getting this done. I understand this committee's is the role and to be an innovative. It's a great innovative program, and we are very supportive of this program, and we just need to continue to work together among our two divisions to get it done for you. Thank you.
Representative Steele, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I'm going to go at this a little differently. Thank you guys for working so diligently on this stuff. My questions are along the lines of, you know, is this a program that we're taking money from? So reallocating funds to cover these children? So they were already covered by some facility. Are we taking money away from that and allocating it towards this?
These children, is part of the bill is to offset with private duty nursing, is how the bill is structured. And so currently these kids might be eligible for private duty nursing. By leveraging the home health aid through a family member, it would move from that private duty nursing to the home health.
Follow-up?
Is it going to be a savings to the state, having the parent do it versus a skilled facility?
Facility cost, when they're in a facility, it is more expensive. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, and that's what we said we could get back with you on those rates. But a skilled facility is traditionally more expensive than home-based care.
Okay. Got like three small ones. Sure.
Taxes. So when they receive the $25 an hour, are we paying tax on that, federal taxes? It's income, right?
That would be based off their employment with the home health agency, and depending on how that arrangement is set up as far as the tax situation.
I mean, so just I'm going to throw another curveball, because I mean they're not able to set up like a small business and have the home agency pay them as a 1099. I mean, it's coming through as an employee, right?
That is traditionally how I understand home health agencies, that they have to be employed by the home health agency is a requirement in this, which would not be a 1099.
Okay.
Follow up?
And just to follow up, and this is, you can give this to me sometime this week or month or whatever. I just want to balance by every kid that's in, or child or person in multiple buckets of Medicaid. Because my concern is that you have, you know, I'm making up numbers now, $100,000 allocated for this child to have, you know, this care. But that same child is in 12 buckets, and there's $100,000 in all 12 of those buckets. So there's $1.2 million assigned to that child, and they're only getting, you know, 100 grand of it in total, because we have overhead for staffing. You have to have people in all these different categories. So I just want to understand all the different buckets of funding that come in, and if people are in multiple buckets. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we'll follow up with you to make sure we get the ask correct and follow up on that front.
Please.
All good. Additional questions, members? Representative Lopez, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation, very detailed. I really, you know, enjoy it. I have a question about the caregivers. When they take the 84 hours training, if they don't speak the language, if they don't speak English, do they have any type of accommodations, translations, or interpretations?
So we already, you know, a lot of this training for the 85 hours is, you know, as I mentioned, we have the 75 hours on the federal side. So that would already be accounted for. I mean, that's something I could take it back to make sure that we've addressed in our consultation with Department of Health, Board of Nursing. But if the medically fragile caregiver, family caregiver, is an employee of the home health, then the home health would need to make sure that they're providing that training in a language in which that employee can understand.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Additional questions, members? All right, seeing none, thank you both so much for being here. All right, next up, our next presentation is going to be graduate medical education in Florida. In the last 10 years or so, we significantly increased our state spending on graduate medical education, or residencies, in hope of reducing our physician workforce shortage and increasing access to physician care. But we never actually measured whether it worked or not. The speaker tasked OPAGA with studying this issue, and they spent over a year collecting data and trying to figure out the impact of these programs. With us from OPAGA to present their findings is Wendy Scott, the staff director for the Health and Human Services Unit. Ms. Scott, you're recognized.
Good afternoon. I'm trying to find our presentation.
So if you close the first presentation, it's going to be on the home screen. Using the computer right here.
Got it.
And it's going to be, oh, there you go. Perfect.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Wendy Scott, and I am the staff director for Health and Human Services Policy Area within the Legislature's Research Office, OPAGA. This is a presentation of OPAGA's review of graduate medical education in Florida. Thank you, Chair Tuck and committee members, for allowing me to present our review. For this presentation, I will highlight information from OPAGA's review, including the project scope and methodology we used, background information about graduate medical education, federal and state funding, growth in healthcare facilities, growth in medical school graduates and growth in positions over time. We will discuss student and resident retention to being a Florida physician, and then I'll talk about barriers and preliminary recommendations. OPAGA was directed by the legislature to review how funding changes and other state programmatic factors over the past 10 years affected GME residency placements and physician retention in Florida. OPAGA used a variety of research methods to conduct the review, including a literature review, federal and state program document review, information and data requests, sponsoring institutions, Department of Health, ACA, the Board of Governors, and national accrediting entities. We did an assessment of stakeholder perspectives, including surveys of 84 healthcare facilities and 57 sponsoring institutions, and interviews of stakeholders. We conducted retention analyses, federal funding analyses, and growth of GME position analyses. First, I will provide background information on physician workforce statistics, the process of training to become a physician, and the entities involved in GME. Florida is in need of physicians, and this is expected to grow. In calendar year 2020, Florida ranked 25th in the nation for active physicians per capita, and we had 274 active physicians per 100,000 population. As Florida's population has grown, so too has its need for physicians. If current trends continue, a shortfall of approximately 18,000 physicians is projected by the year 2035, and we are estimated to meet only 77% of the projected demand at that time. In fiscal year 21-22, Florida had only 1% more physicians per 100,000 population than we did in fiscal year 12-13. This slide shows the pathway a student must follow to become a licensed physician. These steps are important as they show the pipeline that leads to having trained physicians. In the United States, the pathway to becoming a physician requires graduation from a four-year college or university and an accredited osteopathic or allopathic medical school, acceptance into a 3 to 5 year residency program. The residency program provides supervised clinical experiences in the physician specialty area. Entering a residency program requires a license to practice through a training license. But for full licensure, Florida requires candidates to complete 1 year of residency and pass the national exam. Upon completion of a residency program and passing the board certification in that specialty, physicians may continue their GME in subspecialty areas by participating in a 1 to 3 year fellowship program. The green portion of this chart reflects the GME training. There are multiple entities responsible for administering the GME program. These entities include the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, which accredits sponsoring institutions and GME programs. Then there are sponsoring institutions, such as universities, teaching hospitals, or federally qualified health centers, which oversee, support, and administer the GME residency programs. They are also responsible for meeting accreditation standards and also for organizing the partnership with the participation sites or the rotation sites. Participation sites, or the healthcare facilities themselves, provide residents with the range and breadth of experience required in a given specialty area. You'll see on the right side of the slide that federal and state funding for GME training goes directly to the healthcare facilities that train the residents rather than the sponsoring institutions that maintain the accredited GME program. We'll discuss more about funding in the next section. The The next group of slides show how GME is funded by the federal and the state government. Nationally, the largest share of federal and state funding for GME comes from Medicare, or the federal government. While the federal government is the largest financial supporter of GME, they also have set limits on the number of positions they will fund. As you can see, Northeastern states have more physicians, more Medicare-funded GME slots, and more funding for those slots per 100,000 population than other areas of the country. In 2018, the average number of Medicare-supported residents per 100,000 population in the Northeast was approximately 55, while the average for the South was 17. Furthermore, in Florida, Medicare funding supported 15 residents per 100,000 population. Florida's rank in this measure is 35 nationally. Why the disparity between the Northeast and the South? This can be explained by the history of Medicare funding for residency FTEs. To contain costs, Congress passed the Balanced Budget Act in 1997 to freeze resident positions funded through Medicare at 1996 levels. Most early GME programs were located in the Northeast and had time to grow before these funding caps were put in place. Resident FTEs above the Medicare cap do not receive federal funding. This means that position caps have largely remained unchanged nationwide since 1996. Nationally, at most hospitals, Medicare funds the same number of slots for physician residents today as they funded in 1996. So this leads to state. What has Florida done? Florida has made a significant investment in GME over the past 10 years by creating multiple funding programs through its Medicaid program, which receives federal matching dollars. This slide shows the multiple funding programs intended to support and expand GME over the years. The statewide medical residency program, the second highest funded program, provides funding for all physician specialties based on an FTE resident count. The indirect medical education program, the highest funded program, provides funding to teaching hospitals for overall costs and will be discussed later in this presentation in more detail. The high tertiary care and the severe deficit programs fund hospitals offering highly specialized care and physician specialties that are in high demand, such as urology, ophthalmology, infectious disease, and hematology oncology. The psychiatry and behavioral health programs were established to support mental and behavioral health residencies. The primary care programs were added to fund GME in areas of the state that have low access to primary care physicians. And the startup bonus program and the slots for doctors program were established to encourage the growth of GME programs in specialties that are in a statewide supply and demand deficit, such as anesthesiology, cardiology, and family medicine. As a result of Florida expanding the Medicaid funding programs, in fiscal year 21-22, about half of Florida's GME funding came from federal Medicare, and half came through state Medicaid funding and federal match. The total funding was approximately $1.5 billion. Medicaid funding for GME programs can be broken up into two categories, direct and indirect funds. Direct GME, which is represented by the light blue color in the bars, funds direct services such as resident salaries, supervisory physician salaries, and other GME programmatic expenses. Indirect GME, that's represented by the darker blue color, funds are dispersed to teaching hospitals to cover the higher costs associated with having a GME program, such as additional testing or studies that residents may order as part of their training. State funding for GME programs and the IME program together have increased from approximately $80 million in fiscal year 2013-14 to approximately $1,044 million in state fiscal year 2023-24, a 1,205% increase. The most significant increase over the past 4 years has been in the IME, or the indirect medical education funding. The next slide will break out the funding programs that are included in the direct GME, or that's in the light blue part of the bar. GME funding is provided through the various initiatives that I previously mentioned, such as the statewide Medicaid residency program, slots for doctors, and the startup bonus program, in addition to others. Since 2013, when the statewide Medicaid residency program was first established, state appropriations for GME funding programs have increased from approximately $80 million to approximately $431 million, which is a 439% increase. As discussed earlier, funding for GME is provided directly to healthcare facilities, which includes hospitals as well as federally qualified health centers and behavioral health facilities. Federally qualified health centers are safety net providers that primarily provide outpatient clinic services. And behavioral health facilities are facilities that provide evaluation, diagnosis, care, treatment, training, or hospitalizations of people in need of mental health treatment. So as you can see, the state has invested millions of dollars in GME. What have we gotten as a result? The next three slides will show you growth in some of the areas that we've seen. The number of healthcare facilities receiving GME funds has increased by 84% over the past 10 years, from 43 facilities to 79. There are more facilities participating in the GME program, which is helpful to us because they offer residents participation sites or clinical rotation sites that prepare them to be trained physicians. The number of sponsoring institutions has remained relatively stable. Over the past 10 years, the number of Florida medical school graduates has grown by 39%, from 976 to 1,354. This is important because medical school graduates then go on to residency placements and then go on to be licensed physicians. So we're seeing more graduates out of our medical schools. This slide will give you an idea of the number of accredited residency positions we have in the state of Florida. As mentioned previously, sponsoring institutions are responsible for meeting accreditation criteria, and the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education determines accreditation status, including number of approved positions. The total number of approved and accredited positions have increased significantly by 141% over the past 10 years, with unfilled positions remaining stable at less than 16%. Despite these increases in the number of residency positions, Florida is still in need of more physicians. In order to evaluate how to gain and retain more physicians in the state, OPAGA analyzed the physician pipeline that I discussed earlier. The next five slides focus on retention of students and residents in various stages of the pipeline to becoming a physician. To give you a perspective on how Florida compares nationally for physician retention, The Association of American Medical Colleges determined that Florida ranked fifth in the nation for retaining physicians who completed both medical school and their GME in the state of Florida. Our retention rate was 79%. This slide shows retention at the earliest part of the pipeline, from Florida Medical School to Florida GME. From academic years 2007-2008 through 21-22, 41% of medical school graduates were retained to continue their education in Florida by going to a Florida GME program. Looking at the most recent year, Florida retained 44% of its medical school graduates onto a Florida GME program. The dashed lines in the earlier years of the analysis represent estimated values for missing data from one medical and an assumption that their rate was the same as in subsequent years. Here's the second part of the pipeline. From Florida GME to Florida practicing physician, the average retention rate was 50% between academic years 2003-04 and 2014-15. Looking at the trend lines, since 2003, the percentage of Florida residents who became licensed physicians in the state slightly decreased from 53% to 47% for those residents starting GME in 2015. However, the number of residents retained in the state increased by more than 200. And this is the entire pipeline. This slide shows from Florida Medical School to Florida GME, and then to Florida Practicing Physician. The best results for retention are achieved when an individual completes both medical school and GME in Florida. As you can see, for Florida medical school graduates who started GME between calendar years 2008 and 2015, who also went to a Florida GME program, approximately 75% were licensed and practicing in Florida 2 years after completion of their GME training. In contrast, only 42% of those who started their GME training but went to medical school outside of Florida were retained as Florida physicians. This slide is similar to the previous one, but it shows retention over time for both sets of individuals. The top line shows those that completed both medical school and GME in Florida. You see it ranges from 77 to 73, about in the mid-70s. And then the bottom line shows the people that completed medical school outside of Florida but went to GME in Florida, and that ranges from 44 to 39%. The main takeaway here is that retention consistently remains higher for people that go to both medical school and GME in Florida. The next several slides focus on barriers to retention and preliminary recommendations. Physicians who train in Florida are more likely to stay in Florida. So we wanted to understand why some physicians choose to leave the state. OPAGA conducted a survey of 84 healthcare facilities to find out reasons that physicians leave following their residency program. 84% indicated they wanted to be closer to family. 69% wanted to pursue additional training outside of Florida. And 33% wanted to live in another state. In addition to surveying healthcare facilities, OPAGA also surveyed 57 sponsoring institutions. We asked about the challenges to attracting and retaining medical school graduates and physicians. They reported the following challenges. for attracting medical school students, characteristics of the area, such as the high cost of living, child care, and the job market for spouses, were reported challenges. For retaining physicians, the high cost of living in Florida and the lack of funding and low pay were reported as challenges. To address the findings within the report, OPAGA developed preliminary recommendations. The full recommendations can be found in the report itself. To increase retention, the legislature could consider directing sponsoring institutions that receive state funds to give priority in accepting graduates of Florida-based medical school programs to go into Florida GME residency programs. In addition, Department of Health could continue to explore strategies for resident recruitment and retention and expand their current physician workforce survey to further explore the reasons physicians are leaving Florida and develop strategies to address them. Conducting ongoing analysis. The legislature could direct OPAGA to conduct a periodic analysis of the state's GME system and direct the Department of Health and ACA to work with OPAGA to enhance data collection and reliability. Increasing financial transparency. The legislature could direct the Agency for Healthcare Administration to establish rules requiring healthcare facilities that receive GME funding to report detailed records of GME revenues and expenditures. And finally, develop state-level planning. The legislature could direct the Department of Health to continuously update their strategic plan with input from stakeholders. The strategic plan would include GME goals, metrics, strategies, and recommended funding priorities for the legislature to consider. This concludes my presentation, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present our report. I'm happy to answer any questions about the report members might have.
Ms. Scott, thank you so much. Members, we're in questions, starting with Representative Steele.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I just have a couple quick questions. Going back on page 14, it shows a significant jump in the overall investment, but it seems like it's all in Medicaid education for the residency program. Is that the case?
You're recognized.
I'm sorry, Representative Steele. I think my 14 is different than your 14. What's the title of the slide? GME funding over time.
It's the funding over time.
Got it. Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, no, it looks like most of the overtime increase is on the Medicaid residency program. Is that the case?
You're recognized.
Thank you. The statewide Medicaid residency program is the biggest, besides the IME, it's the biggest funding program through Medicaid for GME. And yes, there was a big increase for that program.
I have no further questions. I'll talk afterwards, I guess.
Representative Rizzo, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Ms. Scott, for the presentation. Two questions. First one, or through the chair, of course. On page 18, or slide 18, where you show the map of residencies and kind of hot spots of residencies, I believe that's 18. No? Nine. Oh, I'm sorry, I got it mixed up. Number nine, excuse me.
You're recognized.
Number nine, why is the Northeast so heavy on residencies?
You're recognized.
Thank you for that question. So as I talked about, the federal Medicare funding caps were put in place in 1996. At that time, the Northeast had already established their GME programs and had time to grow their GME programs before the caps were frozen. So federal Medicare funds provides funding for GME only at the 1996 levels. So for programs that grew after 1996, the federal Medicaid only funds however many FTE states had at 1996 levels. Did I answer that right?
Yes, it does. Thank you. Yes, yes, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Now on to number 18. And my question is, at the very top, the unfilled positions, why? What accounts for those unfilled positions? Why do we have unfilled positions? It seems like it's a significant portion of each column. So that's my question.
You're recognized.
Thank you for that. The Accreditation Council for GME is the entity that approves accredited positions. And the healthcare facilities and sponsoring institutions determine how many positions they will fill. Considerations for filling positions include the volume and variety of patients, time availability and qualifications of faculty that they have to train residents, clinical and educational equipment and facilities. So it's various operational considerations that facilities have when they're determining how many of the approved positions will they fill.
Okay, I do have one brief question. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. So residency positions, and you kind of said that it depends on the facility, or there are several facilities, 80-something, I believe it might have been, right, around the state. The teaching hospitals that we have here that are associated with a university, with a medical school, do they have residency positions? And if they do, I'm assuming they do, is there a way that we can increase the residency opportunities there at those that directly have a tie to either a state institution or a private institution, but a tie to that medical school?
You're recognized.
Let me make sure I'm understanding your question. You're asking if we can increase our number of residency positions that are in the programs that are overseen by the sponsoring institutions. Can we grow our residency slots?
Yes, but and through the chair, can we grow our residency spots there where I believe, because of your answer to the previous question, we may have a bit more opportunity, there may be a bit more control because it is a sponsor, it is a medical school associated to that that healthcare facility.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So yes, as I mentioned, the best retention for physicians is for when we have people going from Florida GME, Florida Medical School to Florida GME, 75% retention. So if we can, but that pipeline from going from Florida Medical School to GME is only 41%, I think. If we can retain more of our Florida Medical School students to go to residency positions here in Florida, then we're most likely to keep them as physicians. Do we have an opportunity to grow our residency positions? Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up, all good?
No, that's enough, I think. Thank you.
Ranking Member Casello, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of quick questions. Thank you, Director Scott. That was a great presentation. My question is on slide 11, and it is the American Rescue Plan. office of 2 years of a 5% increase in the federal funding match rate for the state's existing Medicaid program if they expand Medicaid. My question is, have you analyzed how much that increased federal match rate would boost Florida's Medicaid GME funding?
You're recognized.
May I confer?
Phone a friend.
So thank you for that question. There is the enhanced FMAP rate. We did not look at specifically how that would affect GME, but that's something that we can do.
Thank you. Thank you. And on slide 13, does Florida offer any GME funding for nurses or other non-physician health professionals?
You're recognized, and you folks are welcome to chime in as well if you'd like to fill out a comment card, and you're welcome to chime in too.
Thank you, Representative. That wasn't included as part of our study, but I'm happy to look at that further with permission from the House.
As we all know, we have a shortage of nurses also here in the state of Florida. It might be some kind of an incentive plan that we could help with that. Do other states, through the chair, do you know of any other states?
You're recognized.
Any other states that provide it for
offer
nursing?
GME funding for nursing or healthcare professionals, other healthcare professionals?
That's something that we did not include as part of our study, so that's not something that I have available with me right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Chamberlain, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide 20, just help me with some understanding, please. It shows that Florida had 6,211 total graduates that, I guess, went through both sides of what we're talking about here. Does that, just so I'm clear, does that mean we had about 8,000-something graduates and a few thousand of them just went outside the state of Florida?
You're recognized.
Madam Chair, thank you. Justin Graham, Staff Director for Methodology at OPAGA. Thank you for the question. What we did not look at for those individuals who did not go on to GME in Florida, where they went. We didn't have data that would allow us to look at that. What we do know is many of them would have gone on to GME in other states. Some of them may not have continued on to graduate medical education. They may have just completed their undergraduate medical school and not continued on for the further residency or fellowship. That tends not to be the case, though.
Follow up?
So, to be clear then, we had a little bit over 8,000 that did go through the GME, and because we only retained 79% of them, that's how we ended up with the 6,211 that stayed?
You're
Madam Chair. I'm sorry, the 8,000 you're referring to, could you point me to?
Well, I'm looking at slide 20, just trying to understand it, because I'm seeing some really big numbers up there in Texas and California. And it shows that Florida had 6,211 total graduates. I'm guessing that went through the GME. If it's on this slide, that means they went through the GME in the state. And if that number represents 79%, the math would tell me we had a little bit over 8,000 that went through it, so a few thousand of them left the state of Florida. I'm asking the question if I'm understanding that right.
Certainly, yes. We had a sizable number of graduates who left the state of Florida to continue their graduate medical education. I didn't calculate the exact numbers.
Okay. Yes, and so someone that doesn't understand, I don't understand the whole system here, but in doing that math, with the funding that's coming in, that funding, as we increase the total number of graduates that go through both of those, it seems to fix a lot of the problems we're looking for, because a high percentage of them will stay in the state to fill these spots that aren't filled. Am I understanding that correctly?
You're recognized.
Yes, sir, you are. And so Just to try to clarify, this slide that you're looking at now with the 79%, this was a ranking based on Association of American Medical Colleges. So this is not an analysis that OPAGA did. This is something that we are reporting. In our analysis, where we report similar retention, we found 75% of the people who go to medical school and GME in Florida are retained.
Okay. Final question, just so that I'm educated here. California and Texas, I'm guessing, have about four times the amount of schools that we have? They have four times the amount of students, graduates. They just have so many more graduates, obviously, to end up with that number. So they have increased the things that you're trying to increase with the funding to attract that. Am I understanding that correctly?
You're recognized.
They're obviously holding, are attracting a lot more students than Florida is at the moment to be able to have that many graduates. And our funding is to go after that, the exact students that they're attracting. Is that correct?
Well, it seems to be based on what their numbers. They're about four times what we are. So that seems to me. We did not conduct a study of other states of how they are retaining their physicians. But so if you would apply the 75% retention rule, where you retain 75% of the people that go to your state medical school and your state GME, then it would seem that they have more people coming out of their medical schools and going into their own state GME programs.
Thank you.
Representative Gonzalez-Pittman, you're recognized.
Presentation. I have a few questions. First of all, when you asked on Florida's national ranking, that one, did you check into how many of them left after they did their GME, their residency, left for fellowship?
You're recognized.
So for this slide, this is just a ranking from the Association of Medical Colleges that ranked in 2020 all of the retention for the states for both of those pipeline areas. So we didn't survey these people about why they left. Did I answer your question?
Follow up?
Okay. Yes, I do. Okay, and then I was curious because California is keeping 82%. And then on the page with the little circles on why people leave, cost of living, California's cost of living is significantly higher than in Florida. We're getting close, but it's significantly higher. So you would think, I'm wondering about that. And also, did you all ask anything about medical malpractice?
You're recognized.
So, great questions. Thank you for those. When we did the surveys about why physicians are choosing to leave, we asked healthcare facilities and sponsoring institutions. So to clarify, we weren't asking physicians themselves. We were asking healthcare facilities and sponsoring institutions about why physicians are leaving after their residency. So we're not including physicians that have been in practice for a while. This is why are we not retaining them after we train them? And these are the reasons that they reported to us, right? That they wanted to be closer to family, that they wanted to pursue additional training in other states. And so that is what was self-reported. Acknowledging that exploring what other states are doing and how they are retaining their physicians is something that would be helpful and meaningful in the future. We did not include that as part of our study this time.
Follow up.
So if I understand correctly, you didn't ask the med student or the resident why they were leaving. You asked the facility why they thought that people were leaving.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up. All good? Take that as a yes. Representative Tremont, you're recognized. Representative Tremont, you're recognized. Oh, okay. Thought I saw your hand. Representative Alvarez, you're recognized.
Can we go back to the shorted or the unfilled? I still don't think I understand why. It's simply because they don't want to fill them, and they say they come up with a reason that says, I didn't plan for it, I don't have the teachers, but they have the slots? If they have the slots, don't they have the professors?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So ACGME does the accreditation.
Right.
And in order to get accredited or approved for a certain number of slots, the sponsoring institutions and healthcare facilities have to meet certain criteria. And so generally, facilities or sponsoring institutions are approved for X number of positions based on the criteria that they meet. But at any given time, due to changes in faculty, due to time availability, qualifications of program directors and coordinators, volume of patients, facilities may decide not to fill all of the positions that they were approved for.
Okay. Follow up?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. And first of all, I know you were doing the report, so don't take my line of questioning as like, why didn't you fill them? We know you didn't have anything to do with that. So I'm going to say back to you, I just want to make sure I'm getting it. So they could get like 100 slots, for example, but if they couldn't make 100 slots work, they, on their own, based on whatever criteria they had, chose not to fill 100, and they filled what they think they could manage.
You're recognized.
You are correct.
Thank you.
Representative Williams, you're recognized.
Just one, Madam Chair. On slide 26, it states 69% of the physicians wants to pursue additional training outside of Florida. Do we have anything in place to prevent that from happening?
You're recognized.
That is a great question, because I think that that could be an opportunity for Florida. We don't know what additional training individuals are seeking outside of Florida. That was a response on the survey that was given to us. It could be that they are going to pursue a fellowship or a training in additional subspecialty areas that Florida may or may not offer. So this could be an opportunity for Florida, but we need to know more about the reasons that they're leaving. Is it because we don't have what they want, or because they're seeking additional training just preferred in another state?
Follow up.
That this could be an opportunity. Do you have anything that we are working on that may prevent this from happening?
You're recognized.
We don't have anything at this time.
Members, we have a couple of folks who'd like a second bite of the apple, but before we do that, is there anybody who hasn't asked a question that would like to? Alrighty, Representative Steele first, and then I'll get to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I started pondering my thoughts here. It seems like it's an undergrad issue in my mind. You know, and so I would like to understand how many students that go to medical school in the state of Florida and go through these programs are from Florida versus not from Florida. And then how many of those students, you know, leave when they weren't from Florida afterwards, after the program. And then I'd like to understand how many doctors move into the state that weren't even involved in our GME at all, because that might be a number that we're not even equating, it seems like, in this equation.
You're recognized.
Thank you for that. Yes, those are all data points and information that probably are part of the pipeline, but not part of our study. Happy to look further at you know, demographics of who's going into our medical schools, you know, through working with the committee. That's not data that we collected as part of our review.
Follow up?
just a statement. I know there's other states, and it might be Texas. I know North Carolina does it. They require us to allow kids from the school from that state to go to the school before kids outside the state come to the school. And I think that we should put a percentage of students should come from the state. I mean, obviously they have to have the credentials, but instead of going outside the state, because you get higher tuition reimbursement from out-of-state kids versus in-state. So that's just a suggestion. But I'd like those numbers, if you can get those numbers for me, that'd be great.
Representative Gonzalez-Pittman, you're recognized.
Thank you. And I think this piggybacks on what Representative Steele and Representative Alvarez were talking about. There's an algorithm, correct, on matching students from med school to the residency program.
You're recognized.
Can we manipulate that so that we can weight those students from Florida?
Great question. There is an algorithm. And so for the national match, the medical school student puts together their preference for where they want to go. The sponsoring institutions put together their preference for who they want. And then the national match program puts together the algorithm to match them. We, as part of our recommendations, we talked about considering directing sponsoring institutions to prioritize Florida medical school students. So when they are putting their match in, who their preferences are, we think it could be a helpful recommendation for them to prioritize Florida medical school graduates. So we have some wiggle room in who the sponsoring institutions are recommending for their match.
Follow up? Members, additional questions? All right, seeing none, Ms. Scott, thank you so much. Thank you all so much. All right, members, that concludes the business agenda for today. And without objection, Representative Steele moves we rise. Meeting adjourned.